I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In September, VPR and Vermont PBS released a poll that offered a snapshot of voter preferences leading up to the November 3rd election. One of the closest races was the one for lieutenant governor. In a head-to-head matchup between Republican Scott Milne and Democrat Molly Gray, 31% of respondents said they would choose Milne, while 35% preferred Molly Gray. But 24%, a quarter, responded with other or not sure or no opinion, leaving plenty of room for both candidates. Of course, that was before any Vermonters had received their ballots and started voting. This year's campaign season is challenging for so many reasons because of COVID-19, but the number of Vermonters voting earlier than normal is one big one for candidates. As of last Friday, the Secretary of State's office says that nearly 142,000 Vermonters have already returned ballots. That's almost half of the total turnout from 2016. We won't know how Vermonters voted until after the polls close, but the race for lieutenant governor could come down to turning those remaining voters who still haven't decided. Next Monday, Scott Milne will make his case on this program, and today we're going to hear from Molly Gray. I will mention that we also extended an invitation to Lieutenant Governor candidate Chris Erickson, who won the Progressive Party primary. She has not responded to our invitations. And incumbent Governor Phil Scott has declined our invitation. You can find our interview with Progressive and Democratic nominee for Governor David Zuckerman at VPR.org. But back to today. Molly Gray is the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. She's an assistant attorney general for the state of Vermont. She's also worked in global humanitarian initiatives, with much of her time spent in various different countries. And she has worked as a law clerk and a congressional aide to Representative Peter Welch. Molly Gray, welcome back to Vermont Edition. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jane, and thank you so much for having me, and also thanks to everyone tuning in today.
So, Molly Gray, let me start not with what are your broad priorities, but we're going to get there, so I promise we'll talk about that. But I want to discuss something that has come up as an issue first, and I think it would be good to take it right off the top. So you said in our lieutenant governor primary debate that people questioning your level of experience and readiness for the job don't do that kind of thing with a man when a man is running for office, that kind of question gets lobbed at women who are asked why don't they run for school board or a house seat or something else when those male counterparts, including the one currently challenging you for this position, don't get asked these same questions. I want to assume bad faith for a moment, that these continued questions about your lack of previous governmental experience are actually kind of a ruse to avoid electing a young woman. If people nonetheless don't want to elect a young woman, if that feeling they have about a lack of experience, even if it's steeped in misogyny or discomfort with a woman in power or ageism or whatever, even if that's what is behind it, how do you get around that feeling and get those people to vote for you in a highly contested race? Voting is sometimes a popularity contest. It's not necessarily a meritocracy. So how do you swing those voters?
I've always felt, in particular throughout this campaign, that we have to focus on the issues. We have inadequate access to broadband, to childcare, paid family and medical leave. Our businesses are struggling. We are suffering from a demographics crisis, in addition to justifiable social unrest nationally and across Vermont, and also a global pandemic. And I look forward to talking about all of that today. But I'll say this. I'm 36 years old, and some days that does feel a bit young, but most days that feels pretty old. And as someone who's worked in Washington for our congressman, led field missions into Baghdad and to Basra and to Iraq and Africa, worked for the Red Cross, served statewide as an assistant attorney general, clerked for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals for our Vermont judge, bartended through law school, grew up in our state, I feel like I have the experience to not only help us get through this crisis as someone who's worked in crisis, but also to unify us as a state and help us address some of these challenges. But I'll say this, Senator Leahy, who has done so much for Vermont, was sent to Washington at the age of 34. And he served before that as a Chittenden County state's attorney, like our awesome Chittenden County state's attorney, Sarah George, right now. And I've served statewide as an assistant attorney general. And I think if we focus on the issues and we really put forward a continued positive issue-focused vision for Vermont, Vermonters will do what they've always done, which is send good people into statewide office to do a lot of good for our state. And that's what I'm here to talk about today. And I'm really excited to focus on those issues.
So do you worry about the gender questions, about the age questions? Do you worry, even if you think that's a distraction, that that could cost you?
I'm hoping at this point that Vermonters listening today and Vermonters in the primary and who showed that they're not worried about the experience. They know that I have the experience to lead. And I think we're really in a moment. We're seeing that nationally. In 2018, we elected a record number of women across the state. We're seeing young women like Jacinda in New Zealand, who was just reelected at 40 years old.
And Jacinda Ardern.
Who has really shown the world what women can do in responding to a pandemic and really showing inclusive, bold leadership. So those are the women I look up to, but I'm really, really proud to have an incredible team of Vermonters, men and women supporting this campaign, involved in this campaign, and to have a lot of awesome mentors, advisors from all backgrounds. And I know that we will focus on the issues, and I'm not worried about it.
All right. So let's jump off of that to the issues. You know, it was in the primary debate in July, that primary Democratic Lieutenant Governor primary here on VPR and Vermont PBS, that you said to Tim Ash, who was running at the time, who you beat in the primary, that you were running because of what you characterized as his failed record around paid family leave, childcare initiatives, and broadband. And that's partly where that whole conversation came up, where he said, well, why don't you run for a seat in the legislature? And you said, you know, that's a question that men ask of young women running for office. Okay, so how do you plan to move those issues forward in the job of lieutenant governor? Paid family leave, childcare initiatives, broadband, and other things.
Absolutely. I think it's important to talk about why did I get into this race and why are those issues so important? So I mentioned previously that not only are we trying to recover from a global pandemic and recover stronger, address justifiable social unrest, and we can talk, and I hope we talk today about economic, social, and racial justice in Vermont, but there's another crisis, and that's our demographics crisis. Vermont is one of the oldest states in the country. Today, we have more deaths than births in a majority of Vermont counties. I think Chittenden County and parts of southern Franklin County are the exception. We struggle to keep a generation here, to bring a generation back, and certainly to bring a new generation to the state. And why is that so important? That's important because our tax base continues to shrink. Our workforce continues to shrink. 20% of our population is, I believe, over 65, and that's set to double in the coming years, 5 years, 10 years. So if we're going to think about the future of Vermont and what it is that's going to make us thrive economically, it's these exact issues. It is childcare so that Vermonters can stay in their jobs and also know that they can raise children in the place where they grew up, for example. It's broadband so that not only do we have access to online learning for our children in a global pandemic, but that we can attract people to a state where we continue to say we offer remote work, but in fact, 1/4 of Vermont can't geographically get online. And if I can talk about paid family and medical leave for a moment and specifically share a story of my own. I had a family member, a dear loved one, who got sick, and I was working in the attorney general's office. I'm on leave now, and she was hospitalized, and I ended up using all my vacation days and all my sick days caring for her. And it got to the point where at 35 years old, I was going to have to take potentially unpaid leave. And as someone with student loan debt, still working to pay off my law school loans, still renting because I can't afford to buy until those loans are paid off and save up money, it really hit me squarely in the face, as I think it does so many Vermonters, that we shouldn't have to choose in 2020 between caring for loved ones and paying the bills. And that's why paid family and medical leave is so, so, so critically important as we look to the future in our aging population. And also just taking care of family during this pandemic. So I see these as the best economic investments we can make. And these are the exact reasons and issues that I got into the race, which was before the pandemic. But what we know from this pandemic is that these are the same issues that are facing Vermonters every single day. Childcare, broadband, they're some of the best investments we can make as we move forward.
Patrick in Westfield says, I'm concerned about the large numbers of out-of-state folks purchasing property in Vermont during this pandemic. While this certainly benefits the tax base of many towns, are you concerned that this might make future home prices for Vermonters prohibitive? And how would you deal with this if elected?
And that's an incredibly important question, and Patrick's absolutely right. We've seen more homes, this is what I've heard from realtors, sold sight unseen in Vermont than we have in years. I don't know when the last time this potentially occurred. Maybe it was the Back to the Land movement in the 70s. So it's a hard balance to strike. On the one hand, as I mentioned, we absolutely have to expand our tax base. I strongly believe it's not about raising taxes on hardworking Vermonters at this point. It's about ensuring we have more people paying into our tax base. So yes, it may impact the cost of homes and the value of homes in Vermont. But I would say this is the moment where we need to think about if people are going to move to Vermont, are they only going to move to those places where we have internet access? And if I can go back to broadband for a moment, 1/4 of Vermont can't geographically get online. That's something like 70,000 homes and residences. 1 in 3 children in Newberry, where I grew up during this pandemic, couldn't get on the internet, not only because of a lack of accessibility, that there's not fiber cables running to homes in a lot of rural areas, but also just the cost of accessing hardware, computers to get online. And so I think as we welcome people to Vermont, which we do need to do, we have to think about our economic infrastructure and making sure that we have that infrastructure set up so that there are investments in childcare, there's investments in broadband, so that we can welcome people to places like Newberry and in Orange County and up in the Kingdom and in Southern Vermont, not just Chittenden County.
Governor Scott has said that's really going to require a federal effort and a sort of like the rural electrification legislation and more of an effort that's done at a federal level to make sure that we see broadband as a utility that everybody should be served by. So what role or power would you have as a lieutenant governor within the state to try to make that happen here?
I think keeping an eye on the ball, and I know that a lot of governors and lieutenant governors have said that, but what we know from this moment, just for example, around access to education, is that so many children couldn't get online. I was down in Randolph in June and July talking with some teachers, and 3/4 of their kids were not able to get online. And it's just been so, so hard. We've asked our parents and teachers to do so much when we've invested so little in just this basic infrastructure. Broadband today is like heating or water in many cases, right? It's like electricity. To think of homes not having heat or water or electricity in 2020 is just it's just outrageous, frankly. And so I 100% agree that this is not something Vermont can do alone. We're going to have to work with our congressional delegation. Certainly, if Senator Leahy is put on the Appropriations Committee as chairman and we have Democrats taking control of the Senate, what we know is that we have a small state minimum and a focus on funding for rural states that need these types of strategic investments. So I think there's a lot of hope for the future, but we have to remain vigilant in recognizing what the need is and why this is so, so, so critically important to our recovery from this pandemic. And if I can speak just really briefly to our communications union districts, which we see EC Fiber in central Vermont, the Northeast Kingdom has a CUD as well. We see a lot of local expertise, and I know that we can do this community by community. But I see the role of the lieutenant governor is helping to work with our congressional delegation, work with the governor, whomever that may be, and working with our communities and communications union districts to help get this done over the coming years. And it's not going to happen overnight, that's for sure.
Let's go to Penny calling in from Springfield. Hi, Penny.
Good afternoon. Morning, Molly. I'm a new voter. And I like to do my research, and I was surprised to read on Twitter that you are interested in legalizing sex work in Vermont. Wouldn't this include girls being trafficked? Is this something you were saying to appease the person, or can you answer that?
Molly Gray?
Hi, Penny. Thank you so much for your call. I have received a lot of questions about Vermont's sex work policies recently. We're not quite sure why that is, but I appreciate your question. I certainly support initiatives here in Vermont to understand more about human trafficking as it exists in the state. I work in the Attorney General's office. We have a human trafficking task force statewide. I would continue to support their efforts. Absolutely. I think that we need more more information. We need to collect more data on how sex work happens in Vermont. I think we need to commission a study. I'm a strong believer that we don't make decisions around policy until we have the expertise, the data, in the information at the forefront. But thank you for your question.
Yeah, and I'm not sure this is the tweet that Penny had in mind, but we actually pulled this up before the show because we had some questions coming in as well, Molly. And so you had responded to somebody who had written to you in August on Twitter, and you said, I support state efforts to explore modernizing Vermont's regulation of sex work. This includes preventing human trafficking, promoting safe access to law enforcement and health services, and decriminalizing sex work. So you're not sure why these questions are being posed to you? Is that what I'm hearing?
No. We've received a lot of them most recently, and I, you know, it was a question around why that was. But as I said, I absolutely support understanding more around human trafficking and the studies that have, I believe, started in the legislature. But I would absolutely want to know more before making any clear or unequivocal statements.
Let's go to Lucy, who's calling in from Marshfield. Lucy, hi. What's your question?
Hi. Yes. Molly, I was wondering how you see yourself, assuming Governor Scott is reelected, how you see yourself collaborating with him. I know that he said he wants to have Scott Milne be the new lieutenant governor. And if you get in, just how do you see collaborating with him?
Thank you, Lucy. You know, before truly deciding to run, I took a lot of time to meet with our former lieutenant governors, former lieutenant governor Madeline Cunin, Doug Racine, Howard Dean, all who have endorsed my candidacy, also David Zuckerman. And I sat down with Governor Scott as well and really shared my reasons for running around our demographic challenges and figuring out this challenge of keeping a generation here. I know that's something that he's been working on. It's something that the legislature has been working on. So I know that we'll be able to work well together. I do feel confident of that. But I think the bigger thing that I'd like to share is what I've been doing throughout my life, be it clerking for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Vermont's judge, where if you're working on the rule of law and writing opinions, you don't talk about what party or political affiliation you have. You focus on writing a good legal opinion. When I was working for the Red Cross, we would never stop and say, you know, what party do you affiliate with? We talk about how to get humanitarian assistance, you know, across the world to places in conflict, or advocating for the rights of those detained at Guantanamo Bay. So I feel really strongly that, you know, first and foremost, I'm a Vermonter, and that my experience has been working across party lines, putting issues first, bringing people together around issues, and then certainly here in our state, putting our families, our communities, and our workers at the forefront when we just don't have time for partisan politics. We have a lot of work that we need to do, and I look forward to being part of the future.
But that may be the culture of the work that you've been doing in the humanitarian sphere, and it may be even the way that you would like to work as a lieutenant governor. But if that's a one-sided culture or value, you know, that's going to limit your possibilities of collaborating with the person in power in the position of the governor. I mean, it's one thing to say, I don't want to, you know, I don't see party affiliation. If the person who's in charge does, that's a challenge.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Of course, I think there have been challenges in the past, but I strongly believe as a philosophy of leadership that if you focus on an issue, let's just talk about childcare for a moment. And one success story that we did see over the last 6 months, coming out of this pandemic or as a pandemic picked up, it was very clear that working folks and parents were trying to access childcare that didn't exist. And I know our governor, working with our congressional delegation, with Let's Grow Kids, and with the legislature, allocated $5 million for childcare, emergency childcare access here in Vermont. I see myself as a convener. I'm really, really proud to receive the support of Democrats, Republicans, and progressives across the state. And I think I'm a candidate that's able to truly focus on leadership that's unifying and inclusive. You know, we talk about Jacinda Ardern, and if I can look up to someone, it's someone like that who is able to bring Vermont together around issues and solutions and being truly inclusive as a leader.
And let's go to Nathan, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Molly. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My question to Molly is, if you become lieutenant governor, what is your understanding of developmental services in Vermont, and what can you do to positively affect the lives of people receiving services from mental health agencies in the state? Thank you.
Molly Gray?
Nathan, thanks so much for your call. And it's such an important question. We just finished 8 community forums across the state. And I have to tell you, in nearly every single forum, we received questions about mental health and support services for Vermonters. I think a lot of Vermonters are struggling right now, not only because of this pandemic, but because a lot of the basic avenues we have for accessing mental health and support services have been cut. And I know our service providers are doing all that they can. And if I can provide just one example, earlier this spring when COVID hit, as a campaign, we were trying to figure out what can we do to support relief. And one effort was to host regular town hall meetings with information for Vermonters. And one of them was on mental health and support services. And it was terrific. We had Steps to End Domestic Violence come on and some other individuals and experts. And one thing they were saying was, well, we've moved everything online. And so individuals around the state can access services online. Well, that only works in a global pandemic if you have access to broadband and internet. So I raise that because I think this is just another area where investments in broadband allow for investments in telemedicine, investments in mental health and support services, and ensuring we have access statewide. But I wanted to share something else. I do serve statewide as an assistant attorney general. And what we know in Vermont is that we've had more officer-involved shootings over the last couple of years than ever before, effectually suicide by cop. And a lot of times asking police, or police are responding to mental health crisis. And from that, I can certainly say that we have to invest in mental health and support services. I think we invest heavily in incarceration, but don't think about proper prevention, about Vermonters who are struggling. And we know that firearm deaths in Vermont, 86% of them are suicide by firearm. So I look forward to using Lieutenant Governor's office as a platform to demystify Vermont's mental health crisis, to talk about the support services that are needed and that are available, and being a place where there is an open door in convening the experts in Vermont to help us think about a strategy for the future. But thank you so much for your question.
Let's go to Waterford now, where Sean is calling in from. Hi, Sean.
Hi, ladies. Hi, Molly. I have a three-part question for you, and I'm surely hopeful that you're going to get elected. And the question is this. One, how do you plan on attracting people to come to move to Vermont without ruining its rural economy and its environment? Question number two, how do you plan to afford the child care, the internet, and all the programs that you're talking about? And question number three, are you just using the lieutenant governorship as a stepping stone to go to Washington?
Okay, lots of questions there, Molly. So what do you want to tackle first?
Let's tackle the last one first. The answer is no. And then let's talk about how do you plan to attract more people? And then how do you afford childcare, internet? We'll take those two. So as I mentioned earlier, we don't really have a choice anymore around drawing people to Vermont. We have to figure out how we're going to expand our tax base. The number one thing that I hear from businesses as I travel across the state is that they are unable to recruit and retain employees. Yet we know, despite a lot of information out there, that there are lots of really good paying jobs. The McClure Foundation has identified, I think, 62 different high paying jobs here in the state. So how are we going to do it? We're going to invest in childcare because we know that there are families that want to raise children in the place where they grew up. But childcare right now is, I think, costs roughly $20,000 on average for a family here in Vermont. We also know that we have to have the internet because you can't access remote work. You can't start a 21st century business without internet access. You can't even run a credit card machine. So if we're going to be a Vermont that's going to expand our tax base and going to thrive economically, we have to make these strategic investments. So the next question is, how do we afford it? How are we going to do it? I'm a strong believer, and I've brought this up throughout this campaign, that we have to align our budget with our greatest needs, childcare and broadband being some of our greatest needs. And we hear our businesses talking about that. We hear the Vermont Chamber of Commerce talking about that. How do we do that in a way that doesn't raise taxes on Vermonters? It is partnering with our congressional delegation, with Senator Leahy, with Congressman Welch, with Senator Sanders, to make sure that as federal relief funding comes to our state, we have the priority set, we have a needs assessment done, and then we're taking the time to adequately create more childcare facilities and more access to broadband around Vermont, so that as we grow our population, we're ready to succeed, we're ready to grow our economy, and we're ready to expand at a time we have to address this.
Sean was also asking, though, if how do you maintain the rural character and nature of Vermont, and which is one of the reasons that a lot of people are attracted to Vermont, even if they're coming from other places, but B, really affects the way rural populations in Vermont live. So many of us live rurally, and if there's this sort of either romanticization or an inability to continue a lifestyle of a rural culture because of other needs or because of demographics or because other people are coming in and snapping up houses in desirable locations, that can really change the tenor of life for people who live in that rural landscape.
Yeah. And I think if we think about broadband and childcare, I mean, those don't necessarily change the rural landscape of Vermont.
No, but they would certainly change the ability for people with more money to come in and buy land in places where they couldn't before because there was no broadband. I mean, I'm not saying that that's not a reason to do it, but what it means, there's always like the flip side. There's always the consequence or the unintended consequence, things that may be really good for the population that lives there, but could also attract other people.
Yeah, I think we need to recognize what is the Vermont that we want for the future. And being a state that's open and welcoming is extremely important. If I could just talk about Newberry for a moment, where I grew up, and I was just there again this weekend, I can get in the truck with my brother, for example, and we can drive around, and he will point out empty house, empty house, empty house, empty house. There will be no more Newberry, and I think there will be no more rural communities. Many of our rural communities are struggling to have people stay and start families and raise their kids in these beautiful, incredible communities with great schools. And if we don't make some of these strategic investments, so I appreciate the caller's concern, but if I'm going to be a voice for Vermont's rural communities, I think it's also recognizing that we have to address some of these basic infrastructure challenges so that our communities can thrive.
Let's hear from Joe in St. Albans. Joe, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Sorry about that. I was on mute. Thank you. So, Molly, you said you lived in Switzerland up until mid-2017 and paid taxes to the Swiss government. You also claim you were a Vermont resident during that period. My question is, did you file and pay taxes in the state of Vermont while you're living abroad?
Hi, Joe. Thank you for your question. I know that some of my work overseas has been the focus of the Milne campaign and others throughout this election. I'm a lifelong Vermonter. I grew up in Orange County. I'm a product of our education system. I've lived and worked across our state in Newberry and Bethel and Tunbridge and Rutland and Burlington in Montpelier. I've also had the opportunity to do some pretty incredible work working with our government and international partners to launch the first international association in the world. And spend some time in the last 4 years overseas, much like our National Guard or folks that do human rights work on occasion. I'm really, really proud of that work. And yes, I did pay taxes to the Swiss government, but filed taxes here in Vermont as a resident because I've been living here since 2011.
Joe, let me come back to you and ask a question. So when you ask this question of Molly Gray, I want to know your motivation. Is this something that is going to determine whether you vote or not? Do you not like Molly Gray and you know, hoping that this will be highlighted as a way to for people to not vote for her? Like, what's the thing that concerns you about that?
My interest regards, Molly's commitment to the state of Vermont. I've heard other things about, where Molly's been. And, I was just curious as to how if her continuity within the state of Vermont.
Joe, what would convince you? What could Molly tell you about that would convince you about whether or not she's dedicated to Vermont and working for Vermonters, whether or not she's lived here the whole time, or is there nothing?
I don't think that those are the same question. I don't think those are the same question. I guess I'll just stand at what I asked, and I appreciate the answer very much.
Joe, thanks. I mean, Molly Gray, whether or not, this is a question that you think is a distraction, it's one that keeps coming up. And, you said Scott Milne and others keep bringing it up. But, yes, they keep bringing it up. So, how do you sort of put it to bed? It doesn't sound like you checked in with the Secretary of State's office to verify, residency requirements. It sounds like that would have to be a legal challenge. Do you anticipate that happening if you get elected? I mean, this question just keeps coming up.
Yeah. Well, before deciding to run, as any good lawyer would do, I sought a legal opinion. I had it reviewed by the head of the Vermont Bar Association, Vermont's top constitutional law experts, Vermont's top election law lawyers, and more. I think my opponent, and this is mostly where I hear this from, will probably continue to focus on that or other issues, he has a history of running negative campaigns. He attacked Senator Leahy's family when he ran against him. So, while he may want to spend time focusing on this, I want to spend time focusing on Vermonters. And I couldn't be more proud to be born here, raised here. I've had some really, really incredible opportunities to use my skills and experience to fight for human rights globally and work in crisis. And frankly, at a time where we are in a global pandemic, and we have to address human need in our communities, I couldn't be more proud to be able to use some of that experience to help our state and our communities in Vermont in this place that I love so much. So I'll leave it there.
Let's go to John. John's with us from Burlington. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. What's your question for Molly Gray?
So Molly, I know that you grew up in a rural part of the state similar to me, and now I live in a more urban part of the state. And I was just wondering if you could clarify your positions on firearm policy and if you could be specific about what you aim to propose, if anything, regarding that topic and like what your experience is with that, with firearms in the state since you grew up in a rural part of the state. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Molly Gray.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for your call and for your question. It's really an important one. I grew up on a vegetable and dairy farm, and I will admit that we have chickens, and if it's a fox or a coyote headed for the chicken house, my brothers are the first ones to say, what are we going to do? We need to get this fox. So I understand.
And what do you do when you need, what is your family's method?
Well, it's to shoot the fox.
There we go. So. It seemed like you weren't saying something there. You know, there are lots of options.
But what I was saying earlier, I think, is really important. 86% of firearm deaths here in Vermont are because of suicide. I think our state has taken some pretty bold action. We haven't had a school shooting in Vermont, thank goodness. We are continuing to work to expand universal background checks and 24-hour waiting periods, which I 100% support. As a candidate, I would, and as Lieutenant Governor, I would support efforts to close the Charleston loophole. But I do understand that part of Vermont's livelihood for those that work our lands is respecting firearms and their use. But also, I think that's different than some of the emergencies that we see and the efforts and actions we need to see take right now. And certainly, having worked as an assistant attorney general, I'm acquainted with and understand some of those challenges as they impact our communities every single day.
And when you talk about the Charleston loophole, you're talking about the ability for some gun purchases to avoid the background check or the waiting period?
Yes.
So, you know, that would address some of the issues in Vermont. Vermont does have more stringent gun control policies than we did in the past. Vermont also has a really low incidence of gun violence. And as you said, you know, has not had mass shootings of the type that have really devastated a lot of places, which is not to say that it couldn't happen here. But when you talk to that question that John asked about, you know, the sort of values and culture of a place. And we've been talking about that in other areas of this interview today as well. And you said, you know, you realize that for families like yours that are farmers and for other families that are hunting or using firearms for other reasons, this can be a big part of the culture. So again, how do you balance that sort of rural culture piece of things with legislation that can get at the issues like suicide and other things that you think would be improved with more stringent gun control measures?
I think it's important to recognize that there's a difference between weapons of war. You know, as someone who's worked in conflict zones, not wanting to see those on our streets. As I mentioned earlier, we've had more officer-involved shootings in Vermont in the last 2 years, and it's scary. It's police responding to mental health crisis and individuals, in some cases, having AR-15s. I think that's different than those who are working our lands and rely on our lands for their livelihoods. So I think our challenge now is to figure out how to close the Charleston loophole, to expand universal background checks and 24-hour waiting periods, which I would absolutely support.
Let's go to another question here now from Jonas in Bridport. Hi, Jonas.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I was just wondering, Molly, being a young Vermonter in the workforce, seeing my friends and my family leave the state because of job opportunities, the price of land, taxes, what is your plan, if you have one, about how to keep generations here rather than bring people in from other states?
Jonas, thank you so much for your question. You know, we have the highest high school graduation rate in the country. It's pretty remarkable. Yet 41% of our graduates don't go on to any additional training, be it CCV. We have some of the highest community college or most expensive community college in the country. VTC, Vermont Technical College, Northern Vermont University. We have some pretty incredible programs. And what I know, and I'm sure you've heard, is that there are tremendous amount of good paying jobs that exist in our communities right now. So I see this as an opportunity, and this is a real focus of my campaign, to strengthen that pipeline from our classrooms into the training programs, be it at VTC or CCV, or working with our different electrical workers on apprenticeships. There are so many opportunities to get the training that we need for our young Vermonters and to get them into those good paying jobs that exist right here, right now in the state. But to go back to your question on the cost of taxes, until we figure out how to keep more people in the workforce, childcare, getting broadband in Vermont so that people can work remotely we're going to continue to see a declining and shrinking tax base and workforce. So we have to address what it is that's going to keep Vermonters into the good paying jobs that exist right now here across our state.
Molly, we got a question from Paul in Waterville who says, I'm an undecided voter. On Ms. Gray's website, she calls for investment in renewable energy programs. Governor Scott has specifically called for a moratorium on ridgeline commercial wind development. What is your position on commercial ridgeline wind?
My position is that it has to be a local decision. I think as we talk about the future of Vermont, we have to address making Vermont more energy independent. Wind may be a part of that, but I believe that has to be a local decision. Solar, certainly. We see more projects across Vermont, but we certainly had a moratorium, I think, or a decline in solar jobs over the last 4 years. If we're going to be a state that's not only resilient in the face of a global pandemic, where if we can take a step back for a moment, we've trusted the science, we've social distanced, we've worn masks. We need to take that same sort of urgency and collective action in mitigating the impact of climate change on our health, on our well-being right now. We've seen one of the driest summers in a number of years here in the state. Our farmers know that. My folks know that. I can certainly share that. I know a lot of our ski areas are gearing up for the winter, yet they're not sure where they're going to pull water from if we're making snow. So the question is not, when are we going to act? It's how are we going to act and how are we going to act right now in a way that strengthens our economy, creates more jobs, and sets us up for a more energy independent and resilient future.
Well, at Our Man in the USA tweeted at us to say, what sacrifices do you think Vermonters will need to make in order to hit the Global Warming Solutions Act goals? I mean, what specific sacrifices are individuals going to be called on to make?
I think we're going to have to take real efforts to weatherize our homes, but for example, we're going to have to move into electric vehicles as a piece of the solution. And I want to be clear, my brothers work on a farm, and the idea of driving a Prius on a farm is just not possible. But we see Ford producing F-150s now that are going to be electric,
right?
Being patient, being ready to engage. We're all going to have to do our part, but know that it's going to create more economic opportunity. If I can just call out some common...
So the question was specific to sacrifices, because if we're going to meet really stringent reductions in greenhouse gases, that's not just going to require patience. It's going to require significant action, probably more action on all of our parts than we've had in the past.
Yeah, I think it's everything from weatherization to moving into electric vehicles, looking at alternative heating sources, but doing it in a way that allows Vermonters to participate. And that is going to require us as a state moving forward from the Global Warming Solutions Act and relying on the expertise that we have to make that possible for everyone.
Are you saying there won't be a sacrifice that's going to feel hard to me as an individual Vermonter or hard to Vermonters?
I think the goal will be that it's not something that happens overnight, but it's something that's incremental that happens in the days, weeks, months, and years to come.
I'm going to say it one more time only because I feel like you're not answering the question, which is about what is the sacrifice. And a sacrifice, by definition, feels challenging. I mean, if somebody wants to give me an electric vehicle, I will happily take it. But, you know, as somebody who buys used vehicles, that's going to take a while before those electric vehicles are at a price point for many Vermonters. You know, is there going to be a point at which we have to sacrifice that feels hard? Or are there ways that you believe we can meet these goals in the timeline proposed by the Global Warming Solutions Act that are not actually going to pinch Vermonters of limited resources?
I think there will be a sacrifice, and we will feel it, because addressing climate change as it exists right now is going to take that type of bold action. We've waited too long. I think the goal is figuring out how to make it accessible to those who are working our lands and those who are in communities where it will be challenging. But that's the responsibility of the state to make that possible.
So it's sort of a state issue, not necessarily an individual action issue at this point.
Yes.
We got a question from Ruth in Leicester who says, how do you feel about the move to consolidate elementary schools? What can be done to protect towns and schools and move away from top-heavy bureaucratic districts?
As someone who is a proud product of a small elementary school, Newberry Elementary School, the idea of Newberry Elementary School not existing is really the idea of Newberry not existing. It's where our town meeting is. It's where the community comes together. I've talked to communities around the state, being in Ripton or Bristol or Reedsboro, towns that have really been impacted by Act 46. I think that this global pandemic has really shown us that with more people moving to Vermont, with a move to online learning in many ways, I think it's time to take a step back from Act 46 and realize that it hasn't worked for all towns, and then figure out how we're going to save our communities and small schools so that our young Vermonters can access local education.
I just want to point out, I got a note, it was actually Ruth in Shoreham. We had it wrong, not Leicester. So just want to make sure we're being totally accurate here. Molly, last question to you for undecided voters. You know, you've got to make a push here in the last couple of days as people are probably sending in more and more ballots. What's the one thing you want them to know that they haven't heard you say before?
I think we have an incredible choice. You know, we can either fight the change or we can be the change. And I think this is our opportunity to be the change. From our greatest challenges, this pandemic, from our demographics crisis, climate change, social unrest, comes our greatest opportunities. And I want to be part of the future of Vermont, uniting our state and drawing on my truly diverse experience as a Vermonter who's worked nationally and also globally to bring Vermont together for a much more resilient, inclusive, and bold future.
Molly Gray is the Democratic nominee for Lieutenant Governor. Molly, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Jane.
We'll be talking with her main challenger, Scott Milne, on Monday, the 26th, a week from today. The other major party candidate in the race, Chris Erickson, has not replied to our requests for an interview.